What's your view of life after death? What happens when we die, in your view?
I think if you really are surrounded by people that you love, I think you'll probably see them in the afterlife, if you believe in that.
I've always thought that people who try to do good, even if it's not rewarded in their life, then they will be rewarded in whatever they believe in, whether it's spirituality, whether it's karma, whether it's, you know, God.
I lean toward reincarnation. I don't think that there's like a heaven or a hell.
At the end of your life, if the good you've done outweighs the bad, then I believe you'll go to heaven or wherever it is that you believe in.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn, where we are beginning a new series on heaven. You know, in 1998, 49% of 18 to 29-year-old Americans considered themselves moderate or very religious. By 2014, that number dropped 10%. Yet 80% of Americans said they believe in an afterlife in 2014, which was up from 73% in 1972. That's according to a new study led by psychology professor Dr. Gene Twenge, who discussed earlier findings on the White Horse Inn. A national team acknowledged the apparent contradiction between declining belief in God alongside rising belief in an afterlife. Maybe it's not a contradiction, actually, in the minds of its most likely advocates, the millennials. Apparently, the great majority of young Americans would like to extend their personal existence beyond death, even though they're not entirely sure that God will be involved. The Bible doesn't give us as many details about heaven as you might expect, but one thing is clear from the very beginning to the very end of the story. The goal of human existence is communion with the triune God forever. And that's going to be our focus as we unpack both the cultural challenges to belief in heaven and the biblical passages that help give us a richer understanding than we find in our popular culture. And to discuss this important topic, our panel today is Steve Parks, who is a Lutheran pastor and professor at Concordia University in Irvine. Steve, it's always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And Justin Holcomb, who is canon for vocations for the Episcopal Diocese of Central Florida and also teaches at Reformed Seminary in Orlando.
Glad to be here with you guys.
And Michael Brown. Mike Brown is pastor of Christ United Reformed Church in Santee, California. And it's always great to have you on, Mike.
Happy to be here, Mike.
If you go to a typical Christian bookstore, you're likely to find a whole section titled Christian Living. Countless books on how you can live the good life here and now with God's help, of course. But we don't see a lot of sections on Christian dying. In Southern California, you're not even allowed to die. We have, you know, Forest Lawn. We have all these sort of euphemistic names for places. It's really hard to find a church where you walk past the gravestones. Is heaven even on the radar for most people in our culture today?
I used to teach death and dying at the University of Virginia. So how we talk about death and culture is something that's just fascinating. And death is hidden. We have weird creative words for it, passing away, going on, becoming an angel. But kind of the reality of what it is hidden. And the way we deal with death, with the funeral industry and embalming and hiding the reality of death. But it's even hidden in the church. I have friends who have served at churches who just outsourced to the funeral home all of the funerals, and they didn't know how to do a funeral. They'd call me up and say, hey, what do I do for a funeral? I've been ordained for 3 years. I haven't done one, and they want me to do one in the church. What do I do?
Wow.
And they just didn't know. And I said, we have to figure out how to do death as Christians. Baptism and marriage and death, those are huge pastoral moments to really drive home the reality of what's happening in God's world and us living in it. So I think that death really is hidden. And because it's been suppressed culturally, just like a hydraulic system, the pressure is going to come up somewhere. It's going to pop up in interesting places of talking about heaven and angels and vampires. You start seeing it in the images in pop culture, movies about heaven and afterlife. You see it popping up. So I do think that it is emerging, and it is a question. It makes sense theologically, because as the image of God and creatures of God, that we would long for what we're made for.
You know, as a pastor, I think you end up doing a lot of funerals. You end up having to be at cemeteries and talk to people at death. And I definitely think that that's a subject that's not on our radar in our culture anymore. We don't like to talk about death in itself, and we certainly don't like to think of it as God's judgment or part of the curse. And yet we all know that intuitively, right? One out of one people die. We all go to funerals, but at least in our culture, they're celebrations of life. They're memorials, which, you know, some of those things are good to honor a person's life and to remember the good things that they have done. But we don't think of death as a judgment, as an enemy, which is how the Bible explains it and describes it to us.
It's laying a body into the earth so that it can be received back from the dead someday.
Yeah. And it's unnatural to see a dead body. When that soul departs that person and they are no longer animate, grandma's not talking to you or your loved one isn't moving around, it moves us. We don't like that because it's unnatural. When we try to speak of death as the circle of life or this portal that we all must pass through so that we can all go on to some better place, whatever that may be, we're simply not doing justice to this reality that death is an enemy. It's unnatural. It's a foe. And we need some hope that it has been conquered. And we need some assurance that there is really something better beyond.
You even see that in the way in which churches are built in this day, right? You take a look at the architecture. They do almost everything they possibly can not to look like churches anymore.
Right.
I know when I was serving in the Midwest doing seminary work and so on, I got really a first glimpse of some of the older churches, and the backyards of some of those parsonages that the pastors lived in were graveyards.
Right.
And that's where their kids grew up, and that's where their kids played, and that's where a lot of the church kids would go and play after the service and so on. And death was a reality for the way in which those churches were built. But we try to hide that today. We begin to treat the church almost like a school, which is supposed to teach you how to live, whereas historically the church has really been seen more like hospice care. Right. Mm-hmm. Showing you how to die, preparing you to meet your creator, to
meet
your God.
That was a major genre throughout the vast ages of the church. I mean, you have particularly, I'm thinking of Reformed and Puritan works on the art of dying well. Can you imagine a bestseller today? I mean, those were bestsellers.
Right.
And people were dying of the plague, dying in the Great London Fire, all kinds of things that you can read about as historical tragedies. And what was the response? Well, let's deal with our mortality, the memento mori genre of painting, where you actually have a skull, remember death. And wow, what do we have in our culture that says remember death? Remember you're mortal.
Right. That's all been removed. And it's interesting to me as a pastor that part of my job is to prepare Christians for death, to give them a healthy theology of heaven and the resurrection and what God has revealed about these things so that they have some kind of hope. And I can't tell you how many times I've gone and done funerals. You have non-believers there. Every single time somebody comes up to me and says, you know, I've never heard it put that way before. And all I was doing was preaching death as part of the curse and the resurrection as our hope. I'm not doing anything novel, anything really interesting. It's just what God has been saying to us for thousands of years.
Yeah. You know, one of the phrases that we hear a lot is passing away or passing on. And I just want to insert this into the, it was Rod Rosenblatt who first put me onto this, that it actually comes from Mary Baker Eddy. Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, was influenced by Phineas Parkhurst Quimby, a 19th century mesmerist, hypnotist, and occultist. And this new thought or theosophy that really comes out of radical pietism and other expressions came to teach that illnesses are illusions that are produced by the mind. Basically, mind over matter. It's only mind or spirit that is real. The body and therefore sickness and death are illusions. And it's really interesting because, you know, she believed that sickness, disease, suffering, even death were just the result of negative thinking. They're not real. So the cure, of course, is positive thinking, a healthy mindedness that just refuses to accept the reality of death. So she invented the phrase passing on, or passing away, to replace the biblical term death.
And that's become the common term in our culture now.
In our churches.
People say passing away before they say he died.
Writer Brian J. Stanley observes, the word death is a strong and solid word that does not blush or flinch, calling life's terminus by its first name without apology. But most people today euphemize death with that softer phrase, passing away. To pass away suggests a gentle and painless transition, yet without specifying a destination. It is, accordingly, the perfect word for the skeptical yet sentimental modern mind, which is unsure about both annihilation on the one hand or immortality on the other. Passed away allows a kind of vague hope without dogma. I correct students in seminary on this one. You know, when they say that their grandparent passed away, you mean died?
Right.
I mean, not to sort of rub salt in the wound, but to simply say, you're going to be a Christian minister. You need to call things what they are.
But it's shocking, even for those who are studying for the ministry. That's not a word that's in our vocabulary. We want every euphemism in the book to make it a kinder and gentler experience.
Right. And yet it's a term that's specifically used by Scripture. When you get to that first genealogy in Genesis chapter 5, that long list of names, and he died, you suddenly see the curse is in effect. It doesn't say he passed away.
And if you don't die, you can't be raised.
Precisely.
If you pass on, then basically the body is something you occupied for a while.
And this is the importance of talking about this as Christians. Mike, you were talking about doing funerals and people coming. One of the most powerful things that can be done evangelistically, both to the non-believers, but also to really teach the people in the congregation, is to do a Christian funeral. Because the way a Christian talks about death is really different from our culture and other religions. Because as an Anglican, as an Episcopalian, when we do a funeral, it is both a resurrection, joyous service, in deep mourning. We say both things. And you put those two together because death is a mix in
the cross and the resurrection.
Of thrill of what is actually happening for this person and our loss because they're with Christ.
Well, it's as Paul says, right? He doesn't say we don't mourn or we don't weep, but instead we don't mourn as those who are without hope.
Exactly.
Right. We have both.
Right. Yeah. Death causes us to weep. It even caused our Lord to weep when he saw Lazarus's tomb. He was moved deeply as he looks at death in the face and what this horrible thing has done to God's good creation.
And Paul calls death the last enemy.
It's an enemy.
Not a friend.
No.
It's not the happy portal that leads to, you know, bouncing on clouds. Death is an enemy, but it's the last enemy to be destroyed.
It can lead to an end of suffering for a person, and we're happy about that. They're no longer suffering. But we're looking forward to a day when there will be no more funerals, when there will be no more graves, there will be no more burials, and these things will be done and over with. But that requires, for us to have that kind of hope, good news to be announced about one who has been raised from the dead and was seen by many witnesses.
Another of Quimby's disciples, in addition to Mary Baker Eddy, was E.W. Kenyon, a Methodist-turned-Pentecostal faith healer, and this was early days of Pentecostalism. He was steeped in the Gnostic doctrines of New Thought and kind of blended the Ralph Waldo Emerson theosophy with Pentecostalism. One of his pupils was Kenneth Hagin, who died in 2003. If you watched the Trinity Broadcasting Network, you saw Kenneth Hagin many, many times. They called him Daddy Hagin. And he was a formative figure in the rise of what came to be called the Word of Faith movement. He influenced Oral Roberts and other contemporaries, but his most noteworthy disciple is Kenneth Copeland. So then that movement just exploded throughout the U.S. and the developing world through TV evangelism, especially the Trinity Broadcasting Network, but also Pat Robertson, the Christian Broadcasting Network. And among the leaders in that circle was John Osteen, whose son Joel grew up running the TV cameras for his father's ministry. And so you see Joel Osteen today carrying on that tradition along with Joyce Meyer and, you know, countless others. This is an example, isn't it, of how a distinctively American refusal to face, not just distinctively American, but especially American, refusal to face the negative aspects of life. If you just have a healthy mindedness, you can overcome all obstacles, even this one.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because if as a minister of the word, I mean, if we can call those guys that, you're dealing with a text and a story in redemptive history that unfolds. It gets dark pretty quickly. It's only good for a couple chapters. And then all of a sudden, you're dealing with death. In the day that you eat of that tree, you shall surely die, not pass away. In many ways, redemptive history is all about God overturning the curse of death. I mean, Christ comes into the world, does for us that which we can't do for ourselves, completes the work that Adam fails to do, is raised again from the dead as the first fruits of that great harvest at the end that he's going to bring on the last day. And all of it ultimately is about us being brought to God through the finished work of Jesus Christ who conquered death. So if we can't deal with the negativity or the darkness of the Bible, I don't know how we deal with the Bible at all.
Well, know? And I think that that's exactly what you see with those folks. Right. You know, we take for granted coming from a Reformation tradition where we're going to carefully be walking through the text for that Sunday, verse by verse, expositing it, showing our people Jesus Christ, living, dying, and rising again for the forgiveness of their sins. That's not how things are done there, of course. Instead, the sermons are almost always topical, and they're always the sermonic equivalent of a Kincaid painting, mm-hmm. right? It's all beauty and light, no darkness whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. No cross.
What you have is those theological commitments, which, Mike, you traced out in what we're seeing, but we also have those commitments being proclaimed in a culture that has, in the deep structures of this culture, are individualism, consumerism, therapeutic, and privatization. And those are the deep structures that Christian sociologists like Christian Smith, James Davis, and Hunter have pointed out. So when you have that message being sent to a culture where people are steeped in this radically individual, hyperly therapeutic, they want to hear all the positive, none of the negative. Death is a disruption, both mm-hmm. in a theological commitment, but also a disruption in the deep structures of culture. It overturns it. So going through and talking about the catalog of cruelty and death that's in the Bible is unnerving to both the theology and the cultural commitments.
Yeah, it's amazing how much when Paul talks about us suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, how far we will go. Here's one more example. The most empirical fact is that we're all going to die, and we do everything we possibly can to deny that empirical fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say that religion doesn't face facts.
You know, it goes back, I think, ultimately to man's hatred of the law.
Yeah.
Nothing preaches the law like death. Nothing.
Right.
And you can't beat the law.
Exactly. And we want to. We want to do everything we can to not be told that we're sinners, to not have to face anything negative. And of course, death is the ultimate preaching of that truth.
Great
so we
point.
Do everything we can not to deal with it.
To get a better picture of exactly how that plays out, let's listen to some interviews that our producer, Shane Rosenthal, collected on the street, asking them questions about what they think will happen after they die.
What's your view of life after death? What happens when we die, in your view?
I think it depends on what you believe, really.
Right, so what do you believe?
I think if you really are surrounded by people that you love, like, I think you'll probably see them in the afterlife if you believe in that.
Is it just about your personal preference, what you want to be true, or is there a real thing that will happen to us all?
I think at this point it's more like your preference, because really you can't prove anything right or wrong. So, yeah, I think preference is the best choice.
Now, just think about that for a minute. We're talking about the most serious issue that we will ever face in our whole life. We all know empirically we will die. Seriously, the whole matter is going to be decided by basically what I prefer?
Yeah, it depends on what you believe. I mean, you can't apply that kind of thinking or logic to any other realm. If you're on a flight out of San Diego to Hawaii, you're not banking on, well, you know, whatever the pilot believes. No, there are coordinates for where that island is. If he believes that Hawaii is actually in the Atlantic, you're in trouble. And so there has to be some objective fact, and there has to be something that we go by. The question is, what is it? And that really gets down to Christianity being a truth claim. It's not just a philosophy or a way of life or a feeling. It's a truth claim. That claim is either factual and something we can bank on, or it isn't. It really comes down to that. And for me, I'm going with the fact facts that the Bible lays out. I think this is the best thing we have going, that Christ was raised from the dead, seen by many witnesses. We have lots of ample proof and evidence to base our hope on. And if you don't have that, then what else are you left with except, well, these are my wishful thinking. This is what I hope happens.
I'm going to go ask the guy who actually beat death, the one human being who conquered it.
Right.
It is fascinating when you hear the language of it depends on what you think. There's a sentimentality where if you're not going to be in a world that talks about the afterlife, and you're not even thinking about it, this might be the first time that this person's actually really actually engaged it, instead of just kind of going off to some memorial service where they celebrated the life. And when you live in a world that is steeped in this kind of radically subjective, individualized, kind of create your own path, the it depends is kind of like, it's mind-boggling to me on one hand, because I'm thinking, well, you only have a few options. Nothing can happen. There's eternal bliss, some form of paradise, new heavens, new earth, hell, some type of torment, annihilation, or if you're kind of an Eastern religion person, you get absorbed into the eternal soup of everything that is all divine. And whatever you want to happen lets you go in one of these five choices. When you start listening to what people are saying, you're thinking, how does this world work out?
But they can't all be true. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
They could all be wrong, but they cancel each other out. So one of them may be true, but they can't all be true.
See, but there's two things that I think this man brings out. The first is a backing away of any objective truth whatsoever. Nothing can be truly known, or I can't remember exactly how he said it, which, of course, is a self-refuting idea. To say that you can't know anything is to say that you can at least know something.
Right.
But the second thing that I think is really powerful, and this resounds throughout our culture, is the power of the human will. Right? The power of the human will can make you decide whether you're male or female.
Mm-hmm.
The power of the human will can make you the captain of your own destiny. And according to this man on the street and so many others, the power of the human will is going to shape not only your life here and now, but also your eternal destiny.
Exactly.
And your afterlife.
Right.
Not only that, because of your will, you get to pick, but your will gets to create the reality
exactly.
of your eternal
that's the world
destiny.
View.
Well,
that's
and that's the thing
view.
That in the broader popular culture, you have, and I'm not saying there's any direct influence, but just it sort of reflects what you find in this more intense form with the TV evangelists I was mentioning.
Yes.
Because it is name it, claim it. Mm-hmm. Basically, you speak reality into existence just as God did when he said, let there be light.
And there's this backing away from the objective unpleasantness of what death truly is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and as Justin said earlier, I mean, I think it's very possible that this guy hasn't spent a lot of time thinking about it and probably hasn't been to a whole lot of funerals. I mean, we don't have funerals anymore. Again, they're memorial services. Rarely is there even a casket. And if there is, there's really an open casket, which was pretty much common par for the course practice for so long, where you were confronted with death. And like you said, Steve, earlier, nothing preaches the law like death.
Yeah.
And so if you go to a funeral and you see a dead body lying there, you are confronted with your own finitude and that you aren't going to live forever.
Even with cremation, to have the vase there is a testimony to the fact that there is someone here whose remains
right.
are in this container.
If I have pastors who've never done a funeral and don't know how to do a funeral, it makes me wonder. I mean, there's a vacuum in the church, in the culture that's hiding it and thinking about this young man that gets my attention also of like, what's going on? But then I think of what you said, Mike, about the bad theology. The worst expression of this is the name it and claim it, the assumption that we are like God and we can create with our words our own reality. I mean, he said, hey, it kind of depends. That's him playing with the world of subjectivism. But when you have filling in this vacuum, you have bad theology telling people, no, you can. It's not just some type of vague, sentimental, I don't know, subjective. This is you create your reality by your words because God put
You're
that
God.
In you to have that
yeah.
power to do.
Yeah.
That's the convergence of it.
Let's listen to a cluster of these responses and then address them sort of as a group.
What's your view of life after death?
I lean toward reincarnation. I don't think that there's like a heaven or a hell.
So why?
Why?
Why that view rather than all the thousands of other possible views?
You know, I think it's...
Is it just personal taste? Like what I want to believe?
I think because I found more peace with Buddha and yoga type of, not religion, but philosophy.
Just
I could be wrong, but I feel that religion is a man-made thing that gives humankind hope and peace and whatever it is that gets them through the day. So whatever does that for you is what you go with.
What's your view of death? What happens when we die? What do you think?
Your
traditional heaven and hell guy, or is it more like we just stop existing, or it's reincarnation?
Yeah, you just stop existing, then you just go to the ground, and that's it.
So why do you have that view? There are lots of different views. So what's your reason for having that view?
Because we don't really know what happens after. No one really knows, so.
Yeah, we don't know, so why would it be that view instead of any other option?
It's just what I think it is. I'm not really sure, though. You know, you never know.
I've always thought that people who distinctly try to do good, even if it's not rewarded in their life, then they will be rewarded in whatever they believe in, whether it's spirituality, whether it's karma, whether it's, you know, God.
As a Catholic, my view of life after death, as I understand it, is our souls are separated from our bodies and go into purgatory, where they are purged for some amount of time that we can't know. And then after that, where we go, we can't really know.
Wow. Well, a lot of things there. One, running through all of these comments is we can't really know. Another thing I pick up from those comments is the baseline theology of Adam ever since the fall, and the baseline theology certainly of our culture, is karma. Basically, you give good vibes out, the good comes back to you. You did pretty well in this life form, you come back as a higher life form. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's really how you have mastered life and gone on to a better life because of what you've done. And then even the Roman Catholic fellow responded by saying, you know, purgatory. So there's even a quote-unquote Christian version of karma. Mm-hmm. This is not good news.
Right.
This is a passing on, a passing away that is the worst possible news, namely that now this life is burdened with trying to get enough positive energy going to propel me into a higher state.
Right. You know, what I find so interesting in those conversations, Mike, is that you see the common thread of the law written on humans' hearts. I mean, God creates man in the beginning in his own image. And there's certain things that we know intuitively, that certain things are good, certain things are bad. And if you don't be good, you're going to go to a bad place. If you are good, maybe you'll go to a good place. I mean, that's the basic sense of the law, that with the suppression of truth and with our sinful hearts and minds, we kind of retranslate into some form of karma, no matter what kind of religion we identify with. And that's the common thread. And I get that people are saying, well, nobody really knows. We don't have anybody coming back from the dead. So we just have to live with this basic sense of right and wrong and try to do more good than bad.
Which is true if you didn't have somebody
come
back from the
dead. But what if someone has come back from the dead? That's the thing. And people will say, well, how do you really know that? Well, you've got an empty tomb that neither the Jews nor the Romans contested. You've got these eyewitnesses that more than 500 people had seen. And you have Paul saying, go and ask them. You have these apostles who were transformed from being cowards to, after seeing Christ raised from the dead, they're out now proclaiming the gospel. And that transformation endures until their death. What do you do with those facts? That, to me, is so much more to go on than just a vague feeling of, well, you know, I just try to do better and hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of reincarnation and karma is one of the biggest challenges on the ground for Christians, because it sounds so nice on one hand. It's like, yeah, you know, it sounds like reap and sow. It kind of sounds Christian-y. And it just kind of, and so I see Christians hearing the karma thing and they kind of feel like they're the cruel person who's, you know, talking about judgment. You have to flip this on its head. Karma is cruel. There's nothing nice about it. Karma is the opposite of grace. Mm-hmm. We're sitting around trying to tell people, you don't get what you deserve.
Right.
You get mercy and grace, and you were a rebel. You were an enemy, and you deserve this, but you get the opposite. Karma is really just, you know, the law flipped on its head and applied horribly. But there's a cruelty to reincarnation and karma, ethically, because if someone is suffering, they deserve to suffer. And who are you to go against the laws of the universe and help them? Because this is the law of the universe playing right. out on this person.
So, in fact, you're actually hindering them.
You're going against the laws right. of the universe. Well, and a little child who doesn't have a parent to take care of them. Well, what did that kid do in a previous life that deserved to be homeless? Who are you to adopt and foster? Who are you to feed and give water to these people? Yeah. Because you're going against the way of the universe by doing this.
I was shattered by had my vision of Gandhi shattered when I read his comments in that regard. Here's someone widely celebrated for his advocacy of human rights, and yet the Dalits, the so-called untouchables in India, the lowest rung of the karmic ladder in Hindu thought, were not even humans. They're animals. For example, I was in India, was told by people there who come from Dalit backgrounds, told me examples of their parents, for example, getting married, being pelted with rocks because they did the wedding thing on the horse, the traditional wedding thing where the groom goes and picks up the bride. But they were Dalits. So from that lower rung of the karmic ladder, they were pelting them with rocks because they said an animal does not have the right to ride on an animal. Mm. Wow. And Gandhi said, you are exactly what you're saying, Justin. Gandhi said, you are upsetting the laws of karma to interfere and try to raise these untouchables to the level of human beings.
Well, at least he was consistent.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is that it reveals this certain self-righteousness that inheres in our sinful nature. The people that talk about reincarnation in this way typically are thinking they're going to come back at least as something parallel, if not better than what they are now. Right. Few of them think that they're going to be reincarnated as an African dung beetle, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Recidivism doesn't really. And here again with purgatory, the fellow who mentioned purgatory, the same idea here. And you do have the principle of you reap what you sow in Scripture. The thing is, there's also the gospel. The law is you reap what you sow.
Bad news.
Right. Bad news.
Right.
This is what you deserve. The gospel is, even though this is what you deserve, this is what God has done for you in Jesus Christ. There is no real law in the karma thing, and there is no real gospel. The law doesn't kill you. It maims you and drags you through countless reincarnations until ultimately the best you can hope for is not existing.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how people would rather be imprisoned by something that isn't really the law, but is pretending to be the law and is pretending to be the gospel, willingly imprison themselves in that when we actually have someone who rose from the dead and said, I am the way, the truth, and the life.
Right, and then willingly base their whole worldview and hope for the afterlife on what? Nothing. There's no basis.
Yeah.
I mean, every time Shane was asking, why do you believe that? I mean, aside from the Catholic who at least went to his dogma, which is purgatory, the rest are, well, I don't know. I mean, I think it just, I found more peace with yoga and Buddha. And so this is what worked for me. And I'm basing the future after the grave on just kind of my feelings. I'm sorry, I'm going for evidences and facts. That gives me a lot more assurance.
Well, and this goes back to that point I mentioned at the beginning, that in 1998, half of the 18 to 29-year-old Americans said that they were very religious. And then by 2014, that number dropped 10%. And yet, at the same time, 80% of Americans said they believe in an afterlife in 2014, which is up from 73% in 1972. So the arrows are going in different directions. At the very same time, younger people in our culture are saying they don't believe in God. More are saying they believe in an afterlife. Now, isn't that interesting? So you go to a place where you don't have a judge. You go to a place where there is no objective standard. You go to a place where there is no one to tell you either that you are condemned or that you're justified.
Yeah, which as we've seen is it almost an outgrowth of their view of the sovereignty of the human individual.
Right. Yeah.
And I get to choose where I'm going to go, and I in fact get to create it in some
That's
sense.
Right.
This is ultimately, I think, where you're going to end up if you have a faith that doesn't touch the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We do in Christianity. We have a God who became a human being, who walked the shores of Galilee, who had sweaty robes and dusty feet. And so we have an objectivity to our faith, right? The creeds talk about Jesus, who was crucified also for us under Pontius Pilate. It locates him in a specific place, in a specific time, in a specific era. And of course, the scriptures record his specific teachings. People who reject that are left floating in midair.
Let's listen to some more of the responses.
I believe we're measured by the way we affect other people, and at the end of your life, if the good you've done outweighs the bad, then I believe you'll go to heaven or wherever it is that you believe in. I believe, you know, we'll be measured by most of the good over the bad, and mostly just comes down to the intentions in your heart.
Now, I gotta say again, this is irrational. This is absolutely irrational and dangerous to say, on one hand, I believe, actually, in an afterlife. I believe that after I die, there is some reckoning, and I believe, actually, that your good has to outweigh your bad in order for you to have a positive destiny, whatever you want to call that. That means the stakes are pretty doggone high if you think this goes on forever, and your good has to outweigh your bad. But you're banking on something completely and utterly without any standard or measurement whatsoever, namely, that I think my good outweighs my bad. Would we ever allow so much subjectivity to reign in a decision of less importance in our daily life?
Absolutely not. There has to be some basis for believing these things. And then my question, my follow-up question to that guy would be, who's doing the measuring? You believe that you're measured. Who's the measurer? Who's doing it? Is just an idea that you have? Is it the universe?
Yeah.
What is it? And again, we have to go back to objective facts.
And this is why you guys are talking about objective facts, truth claims, because in a world where you would have science and history and talking about facts is so important, there's a divide between the religious and spiritual realm, which you can kind of pick your own pathway, or you're the captain of your own domain and ship type of thing. It's really living in a Gnostic world where you have the natural world here and the spiritual world over there, and they're separated radically. We're living in that world. And
the spiritual world doesn't even have God in it.
Yeah, it doesn't need to. And you have the best case scenario is that people are simply parroting the world and culture that they're steeped in. This is what they hear everywhere. They're unreflective about it. They're either irrational or unreflective in just parroting back the culture. And there's a huge, again, another vacuum where when Christians come in and start talking about, we have a religion that touches down on the ground with a savior and all the things you were saying, Steve, about the person and work of Christ and what that means. It's ready for it.
And Mike, you mentioned, you know, this idea of a spiritual world that doesn't have a God in it. And I think that's the whole point. When you inject the truth of an infinitely holy God into the picture, then the bad things you do aren't just little things that you've done against other people, right? But instead, it's something that offends an infinitely holy God. And that, of course, requires an infinite punishment, something that we could never bear. And this is where the God-man comes into the picture in order to bear his wrath in our place. So there's a certain internal consistency to it. You take God out of the picture and sin doesn't become such a big deal.
Yeah.
But when you realize that he does, in fact, exist, and that's an objective truth, then you're really going to have to deal with sin against him.
That's David. I mean, David, after Bathsheba and murder, his response was, "Against you, Lord, only have
right.
I sinned."
That's right.
And that moment, and he
even though he committed adultery and killed Uriah and a
first
whole host
of
other
God.
Things,
right.
First and foremost against the holy God.
Let's listen to a few more of these clips and then talk about them together.
What's your take? What happens when we die?
I don't know. That's my take.
That's your take?
That is it, exactly.
I don't know.
Are you at all scared of death?
No. I'm in great shape, so.
Boy, you know, sir, I ponder that all the time. I have no idea. I used to think for religious purposes, yep. But I really don't know. I tend to lean toward that when you're dead, you're dead. That's just my opinion. That's just one man's opinion.
So what's your view of life after death?
We cease to exist.
Given all the multiple options, why did you pick that one?
Because I'm practical.
Why do you think it's practical?
I've never seen anybody who's reincarnated, and that's why it's practical to me.
Oh, I believe in heaven and hell.
All right, so why that, given all the options, why that particular view?
Well, I'm a Christian,
okay.
So I believe the Bible. And also, there's just something deep down inside of me. I just can't see that it being the end. I just don't see that. And, you know, I know they say, oh, you just close your eyes and you don't exist anymore. But I feel my soul inside saying, I'm not going anywhere, so.
Life after death? I'm not sure. We could transform into anything. A tree, a flower, grass, a spirit. I don't think that's something that we can know.
I don't think the soul ever dies. You know, our body, yeah. Whether the soul goes up into a heaven or you get reincarnated into somebody else, you know, you're reborn. It's really the last ultimate adventure that everybody waits to find out.
I'm not saying like, oh, when we die, we just die. Or I'm not saying if we die, we go to hell or not. I don't really know. I don't really think about it too much.
I believe in karma. Whatever you do, you know, if you do right, you're going to get right. If you do wrong, you get wrong. And I believe in reincarnation, because I think that if we, let's say we die and we did a lot of bad things now, hopefully when we become another person or another being, we can be a better person.
What's interesting is that person, Shane, our producer, said was actually Roman Catholic. So,
wow.
I mean, he could have been a Protestant.
Right.
You just, in this culture, Lisa Miller in Newsweek magazine wrote a great article a couple of years ago, We're All Hindus Now, looking at statistics showing that, you know, most Americans, including Protestants and Catholics, believe in reincarnation. So, again, this goes to the point that we've been kind of driving home, that people still have this sense that there is a judgment coming, but there's no judge. And there's just kind of a way the cosmic wheel turns that meets out higher levels of existence and lower levels of existence based on our good works, our karma. And yet we can't really know anything about that. We just sort of hope that our good outweighs our bad.
Well, it breaks your heart. I mean, it really does, thinking about these people, yeah, that you see how Paul says in Romans 1, we suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And I love how Shane does it. Even the people says, well, I don't know. And he says, well, why that view? Because that is a view.
Yeah.
Why that one over the other thousands? And so, right, an afterlife with no judge, with no God, or a Christianity with no cross and no death.
Yeah.
But a resurrection is such better news than that.
Yeah.
As you listen to this, and Mike, what you said about it does break your heart. I mean, you can't hear these and not think of as a missionary. And as a pastor, I'm hearing this thinking, these are people who need an answer. And we're living in a culture that is ripe. If these are the answers people are giving to the most important issues of life and death, we have a gift for you. Our answer is Christ, His resurrection. Because He rose from the dead, 1 Corinthians 15, because He rose from the dead, there's going to be a resurrection, and those in Christ will rise forever. That's a really good answer to the question of what happens after you die. This is a rational answer. This is an objective, historically provable answer. And this also answers that emotional question that they have.
Folks, this is the thing. We're talking about something really concrete, death. And the gospel gives you a concrete answer to that death. The answer is just as concrete as the empirical reality of the problem itself. If you face a situation where you hear those words from your doctor, you have cancer, or you have some other life-threatening illness, what is your first response? Is your first response to say, well, no, you know, I just don't feel like I have that? No, well, you know, I think that basically if I exercise more and I try to watch my diet, I think I don't have cancer. And no, of course, that would be absolutely ridiculous. No one would do that. Why then do you take your everlasting destiny with less seriousness? You know, you can't just say, I don't know what's going to happen. I always ask people when they say, I don't think about it much, how old are you? And how many people have you seen die? Do you have any people close to you who've died? You might want to start asking about it, because it is going to happen to you too. It is appointed for everyone to die, and after this comes the judgment. We look forward to being with you again next time to continue this series on heaven.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.